Hello and welcome to A Mindful Emergence on WPVM. My name is Eddie Lesher, and I'll be joined very soon by my co-host Margaret Kirshner and our special guest for this week. We come to you live every Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. at 103.7 on your FM radio dial, or you can stream us globally at WPVMFM.org. This program is also rebroadcast Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 a.m. Our focus each week is on various aspects of recovery, discussing topics such as addiction, trauma, wellness, healing, self-care, and personal transformation, as we take an in-depth and informative look into approaches that can be integrated into daily life. All our programs are underwritten by A Mindful Emergence, a locally owned LLC that's committed to bringing integrated solutions into addiction recovery and trauma relief, utilizing body-centered mindfulness, self-compassion, and therapeutic movement practices. For more information, our website is amindfulemergence.com. And I want to welcome our listeners into yet another weekly program of A Mindful Emergence, and also say hello to my co-host, Margaret Kirshner.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And then also welcome our guest this week, and we're so pleased that he could come in and spend time with us, and that's Dr. Blake Fagan from MAHEC, and the theme this week is Addiction, Prevention, and Recovery Are Closer Than You Think. So, Dr. Fagan is the Chief Education Officer and Family Physician at the Mountain Area Health Education Center, known as MAHEC, here in Asheville, and also the Medical Director for MAHEC's Family Health Center's Office-Based Opioid Treatment Program, and, if that's not enough, Chair of the WNC Substance Use Alliance's Committee on Safe Opioid Prescribing and Medication-Assisted Treatment. So, welcome to the WPVM studios, Dr. Fagan.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
You bet. So, the theme is Addiction, Prevention, and Recovery Are Closer Than You Think. Perhaps you could give our listeners an idea what our focus is going to be on this week.
Well, I think we'll have an opportunity today to talk a little bit about the opioid crisis, and I might bring a unique perspective from the pharmaceutical and provider perspective about how we got into this situation. We'll have a little bit of time to talk about what providers used to do in terms of opioid prescribing and what we're encouraging now, and a lot of the providers are understanding is the new way to prescribe opiates. Short answer is less than not as long of a time. And then we're going to talk a little bit about MAT, which is medication assisted therapy. There's Suboxone and Methadone, and I write medication that's called Suboxone for people that need it for their opiate use disorder. And we'll talk about how that is a part of some people's recovery. I'm for detox and abstinence. I'm for medications as well.
Yeah. And Margaret and I are on the same page. You know, we understand that there's more than one way to find recovery, to get your life back together. And medication-assisted treatment, I've also heard it referred to as harm reduction.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think I became mostly familiar with that term from Dr. Gabor Maté. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he worked in a clinic up in the Vancouver area and wrote a book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which I can recommend to any of our listeners. It's really an in-depth understanding of addiction and recovery. And he uses harm reduction with a very difficult population there.
Let's define what harm reduction is.
Yeah, please. But either one of you.
Okay, all right, I guess that's me. So as I understand it, harm reduction is reducing the harm from criminal activity out there or public health issues that might result from people who are using drugs.
Sharing needles. Yeah, so obviously when they come in to get their prescription, the risk of hepatitis C and HIV is... Well, I don't know if it's eliminated, but it's certainly dramatically reduced.
Yes. Yeah. The data is pretty clear that once patients get on medication-assisted therapy, whether that's methadone or Suboxone, the amount of times once they get, quote, stabilized or find the dose that's right for them, the amount of times that they're actually using needles or shooting goes down dramatically.
Yeah.
Just to give a little sense of what's happening in North Carolina, we've had in the last about 6 years a 900% increase in hepatitis C infection. And most of that is attributed to sharing of needles.
Sure. And that's no laughing matter, Hep C.
No.
Not at all. So how long have you been here in Asheville and involved with MAHEC?
Yeah. So I've been here for 19 years.
Oh, wow.
Kind of grew up all over Clame, Missouri. That's where I finished up high school and college there, and then went over to Nashville, Tennessee for my medical school, and then came here. MAHEC in Asheville has a family medicine residency program, so that's a training program for 3 years after medical school. So I did that training here, and then they hired me on as a faculty member. So I came in 1998.
And it looks like you have a University of North Carolina tie on. Are you a Tar Heel fan?
I am for a number of reasons. One, that my academic appointment is through Chapel Hill.
Okay.
So that's nice. But the real reason is I have a daughter there right now who's a junior, and I'm very glad that she picked there as the cost, although it is expensive, could have been a lot worse in other places.
For
if
sure.
You didn't get my drift.
Well, you're certainly showing your loyalty. So why did you get interested in medicine? And is the first question. And then the connected question is, how did you find yourself drawn to working with people who have struggled with substance use disorder?
Great. So how did I get into medicine? Some people, they have these stories that, you know, at three, I fell and I scraped my knee and I knew I wanted to be a doctor. And that just really wasn't me. I wandered into college and I found that I was good at the sciences and enjoyed them. And so I took a lot of classes, and then I was heading towards a career in research, and realized that in this benchtop research that I was doing, that there wasn't a lot of interaction with people, and that I really enjoyed people, but I wanted to do something where I was constantly pushed and stimulated and had to continue to learn. And the perfect meld there was medicine.
Sure.
And that sure has worked out that way for me, and that the joys of medicine are really the people and interacting with the patients. And where I am, I'm in a teaching environment, so I also get to teach medical students, pharmacy students, medical residents, I really enjoy that part of trying to help people to learn more about whatever we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of the interaction with people, but then the other part is I'm constantly being pushed. Medicine is exploding every year. There's more and more to know. And so I get that stimulation through the sciences as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly gratifying to know that you want to keep learning. I'm not sure everybody in the medical profession has that mindset. But anyway, moving on, you mentioned some pretty grave statistics in terms of the rate of hepatitis C. I was doing a little bit of research earlier today, and from 1999 to 2016, more than 12,000 North Carolinians died from opioid-related overdoses. And I saw that number on two different sites, so I'm presuming it's pretty accurate. Does that sound about right to you?
That sounds about right, yeah. When we finally get the statistics on 2017, we think the number is going to be around 1,500. 1,500 North Carolinians will have died in 1 year in 2015. That's four people on average. And I can tell you, just at the beginning of 2017, I remember hearing, hey, we had about 1,200 deaths in 2016. About three people died on average. But it's continued to go up for the last several years. That statistic that you're quoting is accurate, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. That's what I've read as well.
And looking at the top 25 worst cities in the United States for opioid abuse, apparently four of them are in North Carolina, and the number one spot is Wilmington.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's true. And I have colleagues down in Wilmington that are dealing with this opiate epidemic right now and are really getting broadsided with the heroin down there and the overdoses and the overdose deaths. And they have really mobilized that community down there and, mm-hmm. and have lots of people working on this down there. But that is true that Wilmington per capita is, I think, in the top five, if not close to number one in the whole nation. It, and again, it's per capita, yeah. meaning, sure, there's more deaths in New York City, but
right.
per
there's like 7 million people there,
right,
yeah,
right.
something
every,
like that.
Every man, woman, child, it's different. So, yeah. yeah. And we do have four of them.
Wow. Why Wilmington? Any sense of...
I don't have a good sense of... everything I've heard has been speculation. Mm-hmm. Everything that I would say at this point is not something that's yeah. that I can back up with facts. But
well, and we certainly can't play down what's happening in Western North Carolina. How wide an area does MAHEC serve?
Yeah. So traditionally, MAHEC was started a little over 40 years ago, and their main reason for coming into existence is that there was a healthcare shortage in Western North Carolina, and particularly a provider shortage. And the state legislature started MAHEC in the West to produce more family physicians at the time so that they would then graduate and go out into Western North Carolina and take care of patients. And our catchment area is 16 counties in the West. So we go all the way out to Murphy and to Cherokee County, mm-hmm. and we go over to the east to McDowell and then up to Mitchell-Yancey, if that makes sense. So there's about 16 counties that is our catchment area or where MAHEC is trying to focus to try to help with everything. So in my instance, I'm trying to help with the opiate crisis, but others are trying to help get more doctors out there in the rural areas or maybe help with diabetes or heart disease prevention.
Some of the related.
Yeah, lots of different folks are working at MAHEC on different projects.
Yeah.
Dr. Fagan, how did we get here? Is it all about overprescribing or
yeah,
is it more complicated?
That's a good question. If we could go back to the 70s and the early 80s, we were prescribing opiates pills in this country at rates that they are kind of still doing in Western Europe. And then between the mid-80s, 1980s, and now, we've had a 600% increase in the amount of opiates prescribed in this country each year. 600% increase, over that time frame. At the same time, Western Europe is pretty much back prescribing the same 1980s kind of realm. And how we got there was, back then, if you talk to docs that have more gray hair than I do and worked back then, they'll tell you that there was really two reasons that you gave a patient opiates. If they were in their last 6 months of life, so hospice care, mm-hmm. we have very good data that says that it helps with quality of life, but not quantity of life, right? And then the second reason is acute severe pain. So if you're in a car wreck and your long bone in your leg is sticking out of your skin, you're going to get an opiate in the emergency room mm-hmm. or in surgery. But this whole idea of giving opiates for chronic non-cancer pain just wasn't really happening much back then. And then come along in the 80s, there were two major studies that came out that said, hey, there's these medicines, they're called opiates, and you should be using them for chronic non-cancer pain, like, say, back pain, low back pain, chronic low back pain. And so doctors heard this because the pharmaceutical industry
yes.
picked up on this,
mm-hmm.
and they distributed this information to their over 10,000 drug reps who went out into the nation and started telling the doctors over and over again, hey, you should be using these medications. They're really safe. As a matter of fact, we have these two articles, and they show that they're really safe. Less than 1% of people will ever get addicted. And they were just absolutely not true.
Yeah.
Wow.
If you go back and look at one of the articles, it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they and the drug reps would say that, hey, this is in the New England Journal of Medicine. But it wasn't even vetted like normal articles. If you try to get into the New England Journal of Medicine or any other journal for that matter, you have at least three reviewers that look at your data and decide whether to accept or reject it. And this was just a letter to the editor. It was seven lines. And some guy just said, hey, I saw some people in the hospital and they were on opiates, and nobody got addicted. He didn't even call the people after they went home to see if they were still taking opiates or if they were withdrawing, or maybe they had started buying from friends and family or started shooting, you know, heroin or something. He didn't. There were no questions asked after that. And that article has been cited over 800 times.
Wow.
And the citation, when in the bottom line, what you get to is, hey, these medicines are really safe. Less than 1% of people ever get addicted. And it's just not true.
There was an article in the New Yorker magazine about 6 weeks or so ago. And I don't remember who it was, which company, but they pointed a finger at one particular pharmaceutical company. And it was scandalous.
Yeah.
I mean, really criminal in terms of the deception. And it reminds me of what the tobacco industry did, what was that, in the 70s, where they were just blatantly lying about the impact that tobacco would have on people. If you just tuned in, you're listening to A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And you can also stream us at www.pvmfm.org. And Margaret and I are joined in the studio this week by Dr. Blake Fagan, medical director at the Mountain Area Health Education Center.
So, Dr. Fagan, the people that I see at a methadone clinic that I work at, I ask them information. I ask them how they feel like they got addicted. And so many of them say, well, it started when I had that accident, or I had that knee surgery, or I had a tooth extracted, and I was given pain medications. And they made me feel good. They took away my pain, my physical pain, my emotional pain. And I didn't realize, you know, and the ball started rolling.
Yeah. For sure, the data is still there, and that the number one way that people get into their opiate use disorder, the new term for opiate addiction, is from a legitimate prescription from their provider, whether that's the dentist, the doctor, the nurse practitioner, or the physician's assistant, right? That's the number one way. The second most common way that they get into their opiate use disorder is to start taking medications from family or friends. And I don't have data on this, but I think this is how this happens, is that there's a significant amount of our population out there that don't have insurance. And so you're going to break your wrist or break your ankle, and you're going to go and you're going to see maybe me, or you're going to go to the ER or the urgent care once. And when you get that $3,000 or $8,000 or $1,000 bill, the next time you get injured, you're actually going to go to your aunt and say, hey, I know you had your teeth extracted. Do you have any Vicodin left?
Yeah.
And you know, the aunt is not thinking they're starting someone down the road, right?
Sure.
They're trying to help their person. They know they're still making payments to the emergency department for the last time that he went and tried to get help. And so they're not trying to be mean or anything. They say, hey, sure, you can have a few of these. And then taking opiates, not under the guise or protection of a provider, is probably not the way to go, right? And so that's the second most common way. The third is, hey, I'm going to just get some of these off the street or from my friend to get high. But that's actually the third most common way that people get into their opiate use disorder.
I imagine there's some people that go to their aunt's house and they start thinking, oh man, I need something. You know what? She had hip replacement last year. I wonder, let me go rummaging around through. She'll never miss it.
Right.
How much of that probably is going on?
It's hard to say, but I think you're right on. I have a story from one of my colleagues who said, she had a sofa delivered at her house, and the folks that delivered it, one of the guys said, hey, can I use your restroom?
Oh,
and she said, sure. And then after they left, she said, huh, you know, he spent a lot of time in there. I'm going to go in there and look. And all of her Percocet were gone.
Yeah.
And do you think every time he delivers a piece of furniture that he has to use the restroom?
Probably.
I think so, right?
And if he's not using it, he's selling it on the black market.
Right. And if it was that easy for him to get, how easy is it for our kids,
sure,
for our grandnephew or grandniece, or if not them, their friends, to walk through and maybe not take all of our Percocet, but just take three?
Yeah, they'll never notice.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And there you go.
It's not like anybody's sitting around, oh, I know I have exactly 17 of those left in that bottle in my medicine cabinet.
Right.
Yeah.
So one of the things we really talk about there, one of the empowerments that I'd like to give to your listeners, is that we should all lock up our opiates.
Yeah.
And you really need to count them and lock them up. And then as soon as you realize that you don't need them, you need to get rid of them. And the CDC says there's three ways to do that. One is to drop them off at a permanent drop box. And Buncombe County, we're lucky. We have six places that you can go. You can just Google Walgreens, and there's three of them here in town that you can drop them off at. Also at the Asheville Police Department, at the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office, and the Buncombe County Courthouse. You can just go in. It's right around the corner. Nobody asks a question. You can drop off your meds. They don't even know if you're dropping off high blood pressure medicines or dropping off opioids.
Right? No questions asked.
No questions asked.
That's really good to know.
Yeah. And then if you can't get to a permanent drop box, they say take your opioids and put them into a jar or container. Add coffee grounds and water and make a slurry. And when you cap that and throw it away, it's ruined. Nobody can get that opiate back out. And you've ruined that. And that's great. And the third thing is if you can't do one of the first two things, they say flush it. I'll have to tell you that doesn't feel good to me.
I was going
to
say,
but
that doesn't
if
make
that
sense.
Was my only choice, I would rather do that than have my 18-year-old addicted.
True.
But it seems like we should be able to get to a permanent drop box or put it into the coffee ground slurry.
Yeah, it makes
sense. Okay, thank you. I didn't know that.
Well, that's great information. Mm-hmm. So obviously there are a number of different ways to find recovery from opioid addiction or any kind of substance use disorder. An abstinence-based program has been successful for, I mean, I don't have any numbers, hundreds of thousands, millions, I have no idea. And that works for a lot of people, but it doesn't work for everybody. So what we have as an alternative is medication-assisted. Now, I'm familiar with the term medication-assisted treatment, but I notice you say medication-assisted therapy. Is my language, should I be reevaluating my language or?
I think your language is probably more correct in the literature, but I like putting the word therapy in there because what I'm trying to say is it's not just medicine. The medicine is there to do two things. People fear withdraw, and so they realize, okay, now I'm not going to withdraw anymore because withdrawal feels like the flu times 10.
Oh, yeah.
And then the second thing is it takes care of cravings. And if we can get cravings to as close to zero as possible, it gives people space to start working on the therapy and start doing really good work with either a therapist or in a 12-step program or with a peer support specialist. But the medicine in and of itself, if someone just takes the medicine and does nothing else for themselves, they have a very low rate of recovery, in my opinion.
So medication-assisted therapy, I like that term. It offers people a chance to just kind of get back on track. And then once they do, they can work with other ways of healing. So what are those other ways of healing? What is the therapy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do want to confirm what both of you are saying in that I'm all of the above guy. Mm-hmm. So there are some people that go through detox and abstinence, and there's lots of programs here in our area that you can do that, and they do great. There's others that don't do great, and the data is about like this. If you go into a 14-day or a 28-day or even a 90-day detox and then abstinence program, and then you graduate and you leave that program, 90% of people are using again in 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
So for the 10%, it is great. And I know those people. I work with some of them. Hey, I've been in recovery for a year. I've been in recovery for 5 years. I've been in recovery for 25 years. And that was the path that worked for them. And it worked right at the right moment for them. But for other people, that 90%, they're back using again. They may need a medication like methadone or like Suboxone to, again, take care of the withdrawal. They realize they're not going to withdraw it, but really get to that cravings and try to get that down to zero. And that's what they need to then get into the therapy. So back to your question, what are the different types of therapy that are out there? There's individual therapy with a therapist, and there's things like cognitive behavioral therapy and other things that can be done. There's group therapy. So some folks come to group and they will be seen in that group and actually get their medication for that day, but they'll work in group. There'll be a theme for that day. But if there's anybody that's in crisis or having a rough time, the group will rally around them and support them during that time. There are 12-step programs and other programs like that, like Smart Recovery. And then some people will be connected to essentially a sponsor or a peer support specialist, and they'll work in their other spheres with their behavioral therapist. But then sometimes in those depths of night, that's the person that they need to call on to make sure that mm-hmm. they don't go slip back into using again.
How important is community?
I think it's the key. I really do. I've been working in this space for about 4 years, going on 4 years now. And so I am by no means the expert that some of our folks in our community have been doing this for 30 years. But I really see that the folks that succeed, they have to be contemplative. They have to be ready. So that if they're just pre-contemplative, they're here because their parents made them show up to
right,
see me.
Right.
The chance that they're going to do well is very low. So they have to be ready. But then they have to have a community around them. It can't just be, I'm seeing Fagan once a month and I somehow can sprinkle magic dust for those other 29 days and help them get through it. They really need a community. And if they can find a community, it helps them so much.
Some of the other therapies that have some evidence behind them as being effective in helping addicted patients are things like trauma-informed yoga therapy or meditation or art therapy or breath work. So there's some other alternative therapies that are also complementary.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. So medication-assisted therapy, is there anybody that you would just say, you know what, this isn't going to work for them?
I think that's hard to say. That the only person I could say is if someone is sitting in front of me and saying, I don't believe in what you're doing, I'm not going to take the medicine, and I'm going to use as soon as I step out the door. But that's not usually who's sitting in front of me. Usually what we see is the vast, vast majority of the people that come to be evaluated to see if our Suboxone program is right for them is they've had a significant event in their life. So they have become pregnant and they have this realization, oh my goodness, this is two people on this journey now. Or they've had a friend overdose, or a friend or family member overdose or die, or they overdose themselves, mm-hmm. and they have this shock to the system where they're ready. And what we need to do is to be available as a medical community for that moment. Because what I've also seen is that if someone calls and then they're like, oh yeah, your first appointment is in 26 days, you know, that's too long, because they go back to using and they realize they're not going to overdose or die again, or they feel like they're not, and then they don't make that appointment. When they have that moment, we as a medical community need to be ready. And yet, according to Attorney General Josh Stein of Attorney General North Carolina, in 2016, 90% of people that sought services for their opiate use disorder were not able to find a provider because we just don't have enough providers out there. So we need to work on building that pool up of providers that will help people.
Yeah.
The demand is great.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the funding isn't there as much as it could be.
I agree. I mean, if someone were to pin me down and say, you can only pick one thing, what's the one thing that you think would help the state of North Carolina with the opiate use disorder and the crisis and people that are seeking recovery or in recovery? And I would say universal health care, honestly.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell you how much of a barrier that money is to people seeking treatment. It just really hamstrings us. They have that moment. They want to get help, and then they have to figure out how to come up with money. Well, typically, if you're a daily heroin user, you don't have a lot of cash reserves sitting around to say, oh, I'm ready to deploy this to see a therapist or see a physician multiple times over the next several weeks to stabilize myself before I can move that out to say every week or every month or something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Totally agree. And studies have shown that medicated assistant therapy or treatment can cut the all-cause mortality rate among addiction patients by half or more.
Yes, that's a true statistic that once folks get into medication-assisted therapy, if that's the path they choose, that the data is there that reduction in an overdose and reduction in death by 50%.
Yeah.
And then something else just to note is that one of the places in the United States that people go through detox and abstinence, not willingly, is jail.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when they come out of jail, they're, if you put them with an age match control, so you're a 22-year-old white male or you're a 30-year-old African-American female or something, and you give them an age match control, they're 40 times increased risk of overdose in that first month after that.
Sure.
Because they went through detox and abstinence, but no therapy along with that. There was no medication assistant.
Right.
And as soon as they get out, they go back to using, but they've lost their tolerance.
Exactly.
And so if you go back to snorting the same amount of Percocet or shooting the same amount of heroin, you have a high, high rate of overdose.
Yeah, yeah. Talk about fentanyl. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So back to my story that we got into this as physicians started hearing, hey, you guys, you physicians, and I'm a primary care physician, so hey, you primary care doctors, you guys are all dirty, rotten robbers. You're way under treating chronic non-cancer pain. You need to use these medications. Oh, like this medication, OxyContin, it's really going to help your patient with their chronic back pain. So as we started to get into that, then all of a sudden we noticed that people are getting addicted to the medications. And so we initially had a pill problem in America, and that's where the addiction was. Not that there wasn't the low-level amount of heroin that had been going on since the Vietnam War, but it was mainly a pill problem. And now we really have a heroin fentanyl problem.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened, at least in our community, somewhere around 2011 to 2013, if you talk to the Buncombe County Vice Squad, they'll say, and I don't have a better way of saying this, that for the same high, it became less expensive to use heroin than to use the pills that were on the street.
Yeah, it's cheaper.
And every year after that, the heroin has gotten cheaper. But if you were to go to the people that are on the front lines, like the EMS, the paramedics, and say, hey, you know, I heard you're getting a lot of overdoses, you've got a really bad heroin problem, they will correct you and say, you know, it's a fentanyl problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what fentanyl's done, is one, is it's cheaper. And so every year since that 2011, 2013, it's made the quote heroin, which may be almost all fentanyl and very little heroin, but it's made it cheaper every year.
Mm-hmm.
So it continues to get cheaper and cheaper. The second thing, though, is that fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin. And then some of its derivatives, there's one that's called carfentanyl. I don't know if you've ever heard of this,
no.
But it's an elephant tranquilizer. It's 5,000 to 10,000 times more potent than heroin. The end user almost never knows this. And so if they shoot the same amount, I shoot 5 points a day or I shoot 3 points a day, and it's 5,000 times more potent than you overdose or you overdose and die.
Yeah.
And that's what those frontline folks, the folks in the ER, the paramedics are really feeling and is that, wow, we are doing a lot of reversals. We're getting calls to people that are overdosing so much more than last year, which was so much more than the year before that. And it's because of the fentanyl.
Yeah. Well, we're going to pause, and I almost hate to take a break, but we'll get back to Dr. Blake Fagan in just a minute. We're going to say so long to Margaret. She's going to go and do a yoga class with some people in recovery. This is A Mindful Emergence on 103.7 WPBM-FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And I picked out a piece of music by the jazz pianist Bill Evans, which I think has an appropriate title. It's called Second Time Around, certainly for many of the people that you work with. They're getting a second chance at life, aren't they, Doctor?
They are.
Yeah. So let's give a listen to Bill Evans, and we'll be back with our guest in just a moment. Thank you. Some music by Bill Evans Trio on WPVM. This is Eddie LeSheeran from 7 to 8 p.m. every Monday on WPVM. Margaret Kirshner and I are joined by guests who share their unique experience and expertise in their effort to support personal and planetary healing and wholeness. In addition to tuning in at 103.7 FM or WPVMFM.org Mondays from 7 to 8 p.m. when we're live, or Thursday mornings from 9 to 10 for the rebroadcast, past programs are archived on our show host page for your convenience. So you can easily locate these past programs by going to our website, selecting the schedule, and then clicking on this program, which is listed Mondays at 7 p.m., of course. We're broadcasting live January 29th, 2018. This is program 107. And all our shows are made possible by A Mindful Emergence, LLC, our Asheville-based company that offers classes, workshops, and one-on-one support for individuals living in recovery or wanting to experience recovery. We also offer trainings for CEU credits to healthcare professionals. You can access more information online at amindfulemergence.com. You can also find us on Facebook and LinkedIn. And just a couple of things to mention. A Mindful Emergence is combining mindfulness and movement to build resiliency. It's a workshop for professionals working with substance use disorder and trauma. There's a training from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Friday, February 23rd, and CEUs will be provided. You can get more information about this at discover@amindfulemergence.com. And also, if you enjoy this program, there's one show in particular on WPVM I encourage you to check out, and that's on Thursdays at 5 p.m., McNair Ezard hosts A Better World. This is a show that looks at people and organizations that are working in areas such as hunger and poverty, economic and social justice, and the environment and spirituality. So we're going to return now back to our guest, Dr. Blake Fagan from MAHEC. And the theme this week is addiction, prevention, and recovery are closer than you think. So I'm really curious about what are the providers in our community doing to help with this opioid epidemic, Dr. Fagan?
That's a good question. So the providers are getting the education. They really are getting it that, hey, they have to be a part of the solution here. So we kind of split pain into acute pain and chronic pain. And for acute pain, we're finding that there's actually less opiates that need to be prescribed. And this is pretty data-driven, and we're getting more and more data that's emerging. So there's actually folks now where they're having a certain surgery, and their doctors maybe used to give them 30 or 60 Percocet, and now maybe they're only giving them five for the first day or so afterwards, and then encouraging them to switch to Tylenol and ibuprofen if they're not allergic to those. And those kind of things are really a multiplier effect. There was just one study up in Vermont with Dartmouth, and they showed with just six different surgeries that they do frequently in that hospital, but by the end of the year, because they're not giving 30 to 60 Percocet, they're only giving five, that there would be hundreds of thousands of less Percocet pills in people's cabinets up there. Mm. And the interesting thing is 98% of people were satisfied with the only five pills, sure, instead of the 60. Only 2% of people call back for a refill. So from the acute pain side, we are really hammering that home with our providers, our dentists, nurse practitioners, physicians, assistants, doctors, and even podiatrists. Those are folks that work on the ankle and foot. And they're getting the message, and they're prescribing safer amounts, which usually means less amounts for a shorter amount of time. And patients are responding to that and finding that they don't need as much medication and much less medicine than is in the cabinets. But then we're also working on the chronic pain side. And for folks that have been on chronic pain medications for years and years, we're talking about trying to wean them down to safe levels. And what patients are often finding, not all the time, but often finding, is that their pain scores or their perception of their pain is the same or even it's improved as they wean them down, because there is this phenomenon that's called opioid hyperalgesia. I don't know if you've heard of this, but what it means is that after a while, after months or a year or so of being on opiates, you actually start getting pain from the medication itself.
Really?
It's really fascinating. And so as you wean folks down, and by the way, everyone is scared and they don't want to wean down. 100% of my patients that I've said, like, hey, we've now found out that this level of medicine that you're on is dangerous and I need to wean you down. They've said, I don't want to. I'm afraid. Sure, it's going to hurt. And I do it in a slow manner. And you notice that their pain scores are either exactly the same on half the medicine and sometimes even better. Their pain scores are better. And some patients will even say, well, can I wean down even farther? And I say, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's called titrating?
That's right, titrating down in that case. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, at MAHEC, which for those of our listeners who don't know, it's Mountain Area Health Education Center. It's a nonprofit organization.
That's correct.
Yeah. You prescribe Suboxone, which is also known as buprenorphine.
Buprenorphine.
Yeah.
I had to spend a lot of time learning how to say it.
I stumble over that one for some reason. Now, obviously, methadone is also widely used in medication-assisted treatment. Perhaps you could let me know why not methadone, and what's the distinction between the two?
Yeah. So methadone has been around for many years and is the medication that was prescribed in methadone clinics, or what they used to call OTP, since the 70s. And it's still prescribed in the vast majority of the clinics where people can get a medication-assisted treatment. But in about 2000, another medication came out that's called Suboxone, and that can be prescribed in those treatment programs, but also can be prescribed in physicians' offices that aren't in those treatment programs. So one of the distinctions right out of the chute is that I can't prescribe methadone for addiction or for opiate use disorder. I have to be in an opioid treatment program. I have to be in a methadone clinic, they call it. They fall under these federal regulations.
So you have special licensure.
Special licensure, all
DEA has to come in and strip search you. And
I don't know about that part, but yes, the rest of it. It's very regimented. Whereas with Suboxone, as a primary care doctor, I see pregnant women deliver babies. Okay. I see moms, dads, kids. I can also see those folks in my clinic. Now, I have to get a little bit of extra training, about 8 hours, to get a special Suboxone license. But I can see those folks in my workflow. And some patients, they like this in that they can sit in my waiting room and nobody knows if they're coming back to see me for their diabetes or their high blood pressure or their cold or flu. And sometimes that's what I'm seeing them for, because I do their primary care as well. But sometimes they come back to see me and it's their time to talk about their Suboxone, and I'm able to prescribe their Suboxone to them. Mm-hmm. And they like that environment. It's but other people can't thrive in that environment, or at that point in their recovery journey, they're not ready to see me only once a week or once a month. They actually need to be seen every day, and they need therapy every day. Mm. And so they actually need a more regimented methadone clinic. So they have their pluses and their minuses.
Do you prescribe Suboxone for pregnant women?
Yes. So MAHEC also has an OBGYN program, and they do the vast majority of medication-assisted treatment or take care of patients that are in medication-assisted treatment programs in Western North Carolina. So oftentimes patients are getting their Suboxone or their methadone at an OTP or a methadone clinic. But if patients come to see our MAHEC OBGYN specialists and then reveal that they're in their opiate use disorder, they can start them on Suboxone. And then I can do that as well when they're pregnant. But oftentimes the women, when they deliver, then will come over to the family medicine side, and I will continue to write the medication, the Suboxone medication, to help stabilize or continue to stabilize their lives. If their lives are stabilized, then the Department of Social Services, DSS for short, feels like they want to keep the mom-baby dyad together as much as possible.
Yeah,
and so they really like this balance that we have in our community where you can get high-level, excellent OB services when you're in your opiate use disorder at MAHEC OB-GYN. And then if you elect to, you can come across the family medicine side and we can take care of the moms, we can take care of the mom's substance use disorder, and we can take care of the babies.
Yeah. And you have Project Cara, and we had three women who came on and talked about that. But just give us a quick overview on that, because that's part of the picture as well.
Yes, so Project Cara is at MAHEC OB-GYN Specialist. It's like what I was mentioning, but people that get pregnant that are in their opiate use disorder, they may come to Project Cara a number of ways. One is they're already stable in a Suboxone or Methadone clinic. They get pregnant, and then those clinics or those patients are then choosing to go to Project Cara at MAHEC OB-GYN. And then some folks are getting pregnant and then seeking their services, and then that's when they divulge or say, hey, I've been shooting heroin every day. I want the best for my baby. And they will work very hard to stabilize them onto the Suboxone and stabilize them throughout the rest of their pregnancy. And they recruit and bring in all kinds of therapy services and wraparound services to try to help the mom. And then when she delivers, to help her in her home and in her recovery journey.
Fantastic.
And then we have this warm handoff where the moms have usually gotten to meet somebody on the family medicine side, and they may bring their baby over with them. We can take care of their baby, or they'll come over and we'll continue to write the Suboxone. And because they stay stabilized from Project Cara to our side, the DSS will allow or wants to try to encourage keeping the mom-baby dyad together. And that's just critical for those babies.
You know, you talked before about the distinction between acute care and, you know, acute conditions and chronic conditions. And this is so often addiction is treated like it's an acute illness or acute disease. I mean, this notion that people can go to treatment for 14 days and they're going to be okay. I mean, it's just absurd.
Yeah. I like to say when I'm giving some of my talks, but particularly to providers, but even to the community, is that substance use disorders, but particularly opiate use disorders, is a chronic brain disease.
Yes.
And then I try to slip in, it's a chronic relapsing brain disease.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to then slip in, opiates like heroin cause permanent brain changes. And those are concepts that are really hard for the general public to understand. But I'm here to say it's very hard for a lot of people in the provider community to understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the scenario or the story I try to tell is that, let's say I'm seeing a patient that has diabetes and their diabetes is out of control. And it takes me 3 months, but I really work with them and I adjust their insulin and I finally get their diabetes under great control. The next time I see them, I don't shake their hand and say, congratulations, your diabetes is under control, and take all their insulin away.
Yeah.
You know, people would say, no, the reason that they're doing so well, that they're able to do the rest of their life to be there at their grandkids' baseball games is because of the insulin. And I say, yes, that's what Suboxone or Methadone can do for somebody.
Sure, sure. And I imagine there's a certain amount of counseling in terms of what they're putting in their bodies, diet, nutrition, that kind of thing. Just as in the medication-assisted treatment, you offer additional higher levels of care besides the medication.
Yeah. And then,
yeah, go ahead.
Pardon me. And just to get back to the harm reduction model, the diabetic that after Christmas comes and sees me and their diabetes is not quite as in control as it was before, I don't fire them.
Yeah.
I say, hey.
You don't shame them.
Yeah. I say, hey, what's going on? What can I help you with? Maybe you need a little bit more medicine until we're back to your old regimen,
right,
and
right.
then we can turn it back down a little bit. Well, in the recovery community, people sometimes do some backsliding, and sometimes they need to be seen more often, or they need more behavioral health counseling, or maybe they need just a little bit more medicine, and then later they need a little bit less.
And they all need compassion.
Yes.
Yeah. Stigma, huge problem. What do you notice that you've been able to do in helping overcome the stigma associated with, well, not just addiction, but also harm reduction. A lot of people think that medication-assisted treatment is not really recovery and it's cheating.
Yeah. So stigma is a big problem, and until we can address the stigma and get it out in the open and try to work on that, it's going to be hard to get a good handle on this opiate crisis. And the stigma comes in multiple forms, as you were just mentioning. But one is that if a patient gets cancer and then fights the good fight and dies from cancer, their family rallies around them. They'll talk to their friends and families. They'll put that on Facebook. They'll say, you know, hey, Sally Sue or Jim Bob, they lost the good fight there. But if someone dies of a heroin overdose, many people want to sweep that under the rug. They don't want to talk about it. And I totally get that. There's so much stigma. There's shame. There's guilt feelings. But we as a society have to start talking about this. And if we don't, it's going to be hard to actually start to get a good handle on what's happening. Well, the same thing is happening in the provider community. If you and I was there. I just want to be honest. You know, 4 years ago, if someone came up to me and said, "Hey, I want you to write this medicine called Suboxone to try to help people that are in their addiction," I would have said, "No way. You're just substituting one addiction for another. I don't want to do that." But then one of my patients that I delivered at the time had an 8 and a 10 year old. She rolled into the emergency department dead of an overdose, and it changed my life.
Yeah.
I just said, "Oh my gosh, what is going on?" And people were like, "There's an opiate crisis. Where have you been?" And I've really been on a journey here for the last 4 years of trying to work on this, but also to break down this stigma.
Yeah. Do you have anything more you want to say about our community prevention efforts here in this area?
Yeah. We have such a great community here that's coming together. And with the Buncombe County schools, with the Asheville City schools, they've partnered with the nurses at MAHEC, and they've done two really neat things. One is they have sent out a flyer to the parents that says lots of empowerment. Hey, if your child gets injured and goes to the emergency department, and we want you to ask these questions of your provider. And they are, hey, this painkiller that you're about ready to give my kid, are there any side effects of it? And do they really have to take all of the medication? And finally, when can I switch to Tylenol and ibuprofen? Because we want to empower our parents out there to try to get their kids to be on as little bit of the opiate as possible if they need it. And if they don't need it, hey, maybe just Tylenol and ibuprofen for that ankle sprain is okay.
Yeah.
So we've been working on that part of prevention. The other thing is we now have Narcan in all of our middle schools and high schools, and then just... Narcan is a medication that can reverse the effects of opiates if you have had an overdose.
Yeah.
And now we've even gotten that into our elementary schools through our nurses. So it's with our school resource officers in middle schools and high schools, and it's with our nurses in elementary schools. And this is a huge, huge win. At the beginning of this school year, back in August of 2017, we had two overdoses in the schools. Mm. And
are the police officers and first responders carrying Narcan?
They are.
Yeah, they better be.
And they're trained on how to do it, how to use it. And unfortunately, they're having to use it a lot more than they did the year before.
Yeah. So in the time we have remaining, if someone out there is struggling, you know, What do you have to say to them?
Well, first, it could be the deepest, darkest time of your life, and you're not alone. Millions of people are struggling right now in the United States. And I really encourage you to seek out a friend, family, or loved one, talk with them, be safe. And then the second is that if you'll go on a website and Google VAYA, V-A-Y-A, the crisis 800 hotline will come up, and you call them, and they will connect you to services. And we are very lucky to have VIA here in our community.
Yeah.
They link up with Mission Hospital and lots of our comprehensives in town. I'm not going to be able to name all of them, but RHA, October Road, Families Prez, Meridian. And they'll find out where you live and what services you need, and they will be able to help you.
Reach out for help.
That's right.
You know, I was talking to another substance abuse counselor today, and we were having a conversation with a young woman, and she really wanted to use, and he was suggesting she go to the detox out at ADAC in Black Mountain. And he said, you know, there are people all over who want to use, who somehow are able to get through the day without using, and you might be able to be one of those. You don't have to use.
Yeah, I think hope is powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Blake Fagan, thank you so much for joining us on A Mindful Emergence.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in once again to A Mindful Emergence, and encourage you to check in with us next week when we're going to be joined by Dr. Sandy Nuess, and she'll be talking about combining mindfulness and movement to build resiliency. So another great show coming next week, and hope you have a great week.
You're listening to WPVM LP 103.7.